From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After lowering income taxes, the Bush administration is preparing to go to war against Saddam Hussein while also fighting the war against terrorism. On today's Fresh Air, the history of the income tax and its connection to funding wars. We talk with Stephen Wiseman, author of The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, The Fierce Battles Over Money and Power That Transformed the Nation. Also, Sarah Vowell on why she thinks about the Civil War every day. She has a new book called The Partly Cloudy Patriot. Vowell is a contributing editor for the public radio program This American Life. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Modernistic, the new solo album by pianist Jason Moran. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says Iraqi authorities have told him they will allow UN weapons inspectors to return to their country without conditions. Annan told reporters that he received a letter to that effect from the Iraqi delegation at the UN.
They are ready to start immediate discussions on the practical arrangements for the return of the inspectors to resume their work.
The return of UN inspectors has been a key demand of the United States, although President Bush has said he'll still want to see the ouster of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, even if inspectors are readmitted. The FBI has announced the arrest of a sixth man believed by officials to be a member of an Al-Qaeda terrorist cell in western New York. Five other men were arrested over the weekend. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The FBI does not claim the six men intended to carry out an actual terrorist attack in the United States. They're being charged instead with providing material support to a terrorist organization. FBI agent Peter Ahern says some of the men received training at an Al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan, and he says they may not have been the only Americans there.
Those are things that we are interested in, we being the government, the intelligence community, to find out if there are other people out there that were actually in those camps.
The six men were born in the United States of Yemeni descent. Five were arrested over the weekend in the Buffalo suburb of Lackawanna. The sixth, Mukhtar al-Bakri, was arrested in Bahrain and flown back to Buffalo over the weekend. Some FBI agents suggest the six men constituted an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell, but a U.S. intelligence official says that may overstate the group's importance. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Milwaukee's police chief has fired a white police officer who was caught on videotape apparently roughing up a black suspect. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
A police station surveillance video released this summer shows Milwaukee officer Robert Henry, a Caucasian, grabbing black suspect Billy Miles by the neck and wrestling Miles onto a table. Miles is admitted to spitting on another officer during a disorderly conduct investigation, and Officer Henry claims Miles was threatening to spit on him. But Milwaukee Police Chief Arthur Jones says Henry manhandled and mistreated the suspect and deserves to be fired.
I looked at the issues, and I looked at the video, I looked at the complaint, and I made a decision.
Chief Jones says he was not influenced by a possible lawsuit Miles may file against the city. The local fire and police commission will review the firing. A police union official has defended Officer Henry's actions. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 67 points to close at 8,380 in moderate trading of 977 million shares. Declining issues led advances. This is NPR News. U.S. officials have taken custody of a man described as a key suspect in the September 11th attacks. Pakistan handed over Ramzi bin al-Shib and four other men who are suspected to be members of the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Bin al-Shib is accused of being part of the planning for the September 11th hijackings. He discussed his role recently in an interview broadcast on Al Jazeera, the Arabic-language satellite TV channel. The Securities and Exchange Commission is looking into the retirement benefits given to the former chairman and chief executive officer of General Electric. Jack Welch defended the retirement package in a newspaper article today. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
Earlier this month, Welch's wife filed divorce papers in which she detailed a series of lavish perks that GE gave her husband in retirement. Not only did he get a New York City apartment with a cook and housekeeper, he also got the use of a company jet, a car and driver, and tickets to sporting and cultural events, among other things. Some shareholder activists complained that GE didn't disclose all of the details of the benefits package. Last week, the company's board voted to modify the package. Today, GE issued a statement saying it was cooperating with an informal SEC investigation into Welch's benefits. In an op-ed article in the Wall Street Journal, Welch said the perks he gets have been exaggerated, but he said he agreed to reduce his benefits to spare the company criticism. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ lost 15 points, or 1.2%. It closed at 1,275. The S&P 500 gained 1 point to close at 891. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After leading the way to cut income taxes, the Bush administration is preparing to wage an expensive war against Saddam Hussein while already fighting the war against terrorism. The historical connection between income taxes and the funding of wars is part of the story told in the new book, The Great Tax Wars, Lincoln to Wilson, The Fierce Battles Over Money and Power That Transformed the Nation. My guest is the author, Stephen R. Wiseman. He has covered politics, economics, and international affairs for the New York Times for more than 30 years as a reporter and now an editorial writer. His book opens at the beginning of the Civil War in 1861 and concludes at the end of World War I in 1920, the period in which the income tax was enacted three times and overturned twice before it finally became a permanent part of American life. The first income tax was enacted during the Civil War. I asked Wiseman why President Lincoln wanted to create it.
Well, you know, when the Civil War began, a lot of people on both sides thought it would last only a few months and that they could just rely on borrowing to get through. It wasn't until after the Battle of Bull Run that both sides realized it was going to go on longer. And Lincoln had some fateful meetings with banks, of all people, who felt that if they were going to lend the money to the Union cause, patriots though they were, they wanted to know what the prospect was for being repaid. Nothing has changed in that respect. And so the Union was forced by 1862 to look for revenues. They had raised tariffs already, which was the main source of revenues those days, and the income tax became, for a lot of reasons, the thing they had to turn to next.
Was there a lot of objection to income tax?
There sure was. For one thing, the Union wealth was concentrated only in three or four states, mostly concentrated in New York. These were the citadels of Republican support. And there were big objections that the wealthiest states and the wealthiest individuals were going to have to pay more than people in other states. So there was a big battle over it, for sure.
What was the argument on either side?
Well, the argument was sharpened by the fact that they were at war. But the argument is the same that we're having now. What's fair? Is it fair to raise taxes at a higher rate for those who make more money, to in effect punish them for behavior that creates wealth? Or is it fair to expect everybody at a time of war to sacrifice equally, and especially at a time when so many people from the working class were being slaughtered in the war? Remember that you could pay $300 to get out of the war if you were on the Union side. That meant that people of wealth could pay their way out of the war. Around the middle of the war, the Treasury Secretary of the Union, Salmon Chase, his daughter got married, and he spent $3,000 for a shawl for her wedding, bought it from one of the best department stores in New York. Well, it was noticed that that was the cost of 10 men's lives. So it seemed that you had to have a tax that affected the people who, in fact, were making money off the war. New York became a great wealthy city because of its role in producing goods and services for the war.
So when the income tax was passed, did it succeed in doing what President Lincoln wanted, help fund the war?
It helped. It did not provide more than a fraction of the revenue. It only affected the top 2 or 3% of taxpayers, at first anyway. By and large, the union cause was funded by borrowing, and that caused inflation. It caused budget deficits in the future, especially when the debt had to be retired well into the 19th century. And it made people realize the next time war came that more money would have to be raised from taxes and less from borrowing.
And in spite of that realization, the income tax was rescinded at the end of the Civil War.
In the 1870s and late 1860s, they had the same debate that we're having now. There was a surplus, and Congress decided, guess what? It's the people's money. We should give it back to the people. But a lot of people in Congress said that was unfair because there were big costs mounting up at the end of the 19th century. One was pensions for Civil War veterans, and the other was retiring the debt. But the overwhelming tide was to repeal the tax because it was so hated as a punishment on the wealthy that that side prevailed.
So when was the income tax restarted?
It was restarted during what was the worst economic crisis in American history up until that time, and indeed until the Great Depression. It was called the Panic of 1893. It caused tremendous unemployment all around the country, armies of hobos and unemployed boarding trains looking for work, a tremendous amount of instability all around the country. And as happens with all recessions and depressions, a huge budget deficit in the federal budget. And the Congress and President Grover Cleveland had to raise taxes to make up the deficit.
You point out that by the time this second income tax is being debated, the wealthy were kind of different than they were before that. They were no longer simply the owners of large plantations and estates. What was the new breed of the wealthy American?
Well, after the Civil War, of course, or along with the Civil War, came the Industrial Revolution. You know, back in the 1830s, when Tocqueville visited the United States, he noted that there wasn't that much resentment of the wealthy because they weren't the aristocracy of Europe living in chateaus. They were people who were self-made men and women or families who made more money than others, but everybody else looked upon that as a goal and an ideal for everyone, and they didn't want to punish people who could do that. By the end of the 19th century, there was a sense of imbalance, that wealth was a product not simply of hard work and risk and saving and investing, but of collusion, of coziness with government, getting favors from government, the trusts made deals, the railroad trusts with government. And there was a feeling that wealth was not something that was in reach for the average person. We've been having that debate for a long time. How do we think about wealth? What interested me as I researched this book is that it goes back a long way.
Well, Congress passed a second income tax in 1894, but then the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. What was the Supreme Court's argument?
According to the United States Constitution, all direct taxes, which were thought to be property taxes, had to be paid proportionately in every state by that state's population. So if you had an income tax in which everyone paid the same, that meant that the rates would have to be different depending on the wealth in that state or the wealth of the individual. It would be completely unwieldy to have such a system, but that was what the literal interpretation of what the Constitution required. The main argument before the court was the income tax a, quote, direct tax or not? And when the court decided that it was, it threw out the income tax. But, you know, the Supreme Court then was as controversial as it was in the year 2000. Nobody saw the Supreme Court as acting as anything but the agent of the wealthy and as a group of men who were imposing their vision of society and what was fair. So we have seen the court fall into these controversial periods in the past, just as we have recently.
My guest is Stephen Wiseman. He's an editorial writer for the New York Times and the author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars, which is about the history of the income tax. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Wiseman. He's the author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars, about the history of the income tax. He's also an editorial writer and former reporter for the New York Times. When we left off, you were telling us that the Supreme Court ruled the income tax unconstitutional in the mid-1890s. How did Congress end up getting around the fact that the Supreme Court ruled the income tax unconstitutional?
There were several attempts to reintroduce the income tax in Congress after the Supreme Court ruled, but congressmen were afraid to send something back to the court that would be rejected again. They didn't want to, many of them, confront the court quite that way. Even some who favored the income tax didn't want another episode in which the court would be discredited in people's eyes. Then came the turn of the century and one of the great accidental presidents, of course, of American history, Theodore Roosevelt, who surprised a lot of people with his agenda, was seen as radical, busting the trusts, starting conservation programs, taking on business, attacking the malefactors of great wealth. Toward the end of his presidency, Theodore Roosevelt proposed an income tax, but he had no way of figuring out how it was going to happen. It took his successor, William Howard Taft, a much more conservative man, to agree to a deal in 1909 with Congress over a tariff bill in which he agreed, let's have an amendment added calling for an income tax. It would have to be ratified by 3/4 of the state legislatures. In fact, almost nobody thought that it would be ratified. For Taft, it was kind of a freebie. He just threw it in because he could get more votes for his tariff bill.
So how was it ratified?
It was ratified slowly at first. You know, only 12 states could have blocked it. And at first, it looked like the 12 states were there, including New York especially, that could block it. But what happened then was a split in the Republican Party between Taft and Roosevelt. Roosevelt was beginning to think about running again for president in 1912. But by 1910, he split his party open so badly that the Republicans were thrown out of office all across the country in the 1910 elections, including in many state legislatures where they had dominated for many years. The most important was New York, where for the first time in many, many years, the Democrats took over both houses of the state legislature. And the constitutional amendment, which had earlier been rejected by the New York legislature, was ratified. That encouraged other states to go along, and it was put over the top in 1913, literally weeks before the inauguration of Woodrow Wilson.
So Congress passed a resolution to amend the Constitution to permit an income tax in 1909, and that was ratified by the states in 1913. This basically happens just in time for World War I. How is the income tax used during World War I?
Well, it became an essential part of the war effort and raising money to fight the war. Wilson and his Treasury Secretary, one of the great characters I came across in researching this book, William McAdoo, he was also Wilson's contemporary and son-in-law, realized after studying what happened to Lincoln during the Civil War that they had to prosecute this war with taxes as well as borrowing. And they were determined not to make the same mistakes that had been made before. And since the income tax had just been passed, they had a basis for doing so. It only started at a tax rate of 10 or 11%. By the end of World War I, amazingly, the highest tax rate that was enacted was 77%.
Wow.
It's amazed me to see that.
That was a progressive tax, so it was the wealthiest who got the 77% tax.
The very wealthiest, only the top couple percentage of taxpayers in America.
And I assume the rates changed after the war?
Immediately. In the 1920s, Andrew Mellon, who was Treasury Secretary throughout the 1920s, in fact, people said that he was such a powerful Treasury Secretary that three presidents served under him. He led the way. He was probably the biggest tax cutter in America until Ronald Reagan came along to returning it to lower rates. But even then, it was the Republicans who knew that the income tax was here to stay, and they never tried to repeal it as they did after the Civil War.
So after World War I, when everybody agreed, basically, the income tax is here to stay, what was being taxed? Were stocks and bonds considered income that you could tax? What about inheritance? Was there an estate tax?
Well, the estate tax has come and gone throughout American history, too. There was also an estate tax during Civil War and then again in the Spanish-American War. Then it was repealed, and then it was enacted again later and has stayed as an ingredient. There was also a corporate tax that was enacted as part of the original 1909 agreement. That has remained. And of course, the income tax, by definition, taxes income from stocks and bonds. In fact, it was only when Americans realized that the Andrew Carnegies and the great wealthy of the late 19th century, whose wealth was tied up in investments and who were getting income from investments but not paying any taxes on it, they realized that that was the great inequity that had to be closed.
When the income tax was started, it taxed the wealthy. At what point was the income tax more or less across the board?
That didn't happen until the 1930s with the Depression, the New Deal, and later World War II. And, of course, the Social Security tax of the mid-1930s, which taxed every worker on his or her salary. But the foundation for the income tax, and the reason why I stopped the book in 1920, really did occur during World War I, but it became a universal tax after the New Deal.
So again, we have a war affecting the tax.
Absolutely. The income tax was born of war, but it eventually was the means by which we finance the social democracy and that we have today.
Well, we're in a time of tax cuts, and at the same time, we're preparing for war. We're already in a war with terrorists. We're preparing for another war against Iraq. Is it unprecedented to have tax cuts during a time of war?
It's always dangerous to use the word unprecedented, but I sure can't find any precedent for it. And I'd be willing, although I'm not in the business of making predictions, to certainly predict that this debate will intensify and that the tax cuts that are planned for the coming years, that our debate over that will intensify if we go to war in the coming months. It'll have to be. First of all, the money will have to come from somewhere. Remember that the Gulf War of a decade ago was paid mostly by our allies. It doesn't look like this war is going to be paid mostly by others. So it's going to cost American taxpayers. And as I say, if the past is any guide, war sharpens that debate over what's fair and whether the rich should be getting tax cuts or whether they should be paying more for government. And there's another, if I could go on, debate that takes place in wartime, which is a generational one. If you look at the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War I, and I think World War II, although that's outside my book, there's always an argument, should we borrow and saddle the cost of this war to the next generation, to our children, or should we pay for it ourselves? And you could make that argument both ways. Well, gee, going to war now, that's going to be good for our children, so let them pay for it when they come of age. On the other hand, you could argue, why saddle them with the debts of the wars that we undertake now?
One of the things that President Bush ran on and that he delivered on was tax cuts. Now the surplus that we had is a deficit, plus we're facing war with Iraq and we're already at war with terrorists. And now there's a push to convince the president to rescind some of the tax cuts that he enacted. Looking back historically, do you see any examples where that happened, where recent tax cuts were quickly rescinded because of an emergency situation? And because the whole color of the budget had totally changed.
Not too much precedent for that, but remember that taxes were raised in recent history twice, once by the first President Bush and, of course, then by President Clinton. The crisis in that case was an economic one. There was a feeling that the budget deficits were creating a drag on the economy. And then, of course, also tax increases in those years were the price that Republicans had to pay to get Democrats to go along with spending cuts in their area. I think we're in a period now that doesn't have too much precedent, except in one important respect. As I said, we're about to go into war. War is going to be costly. It's going to intensify our debate about the fairness of our tax system. And when that debate takes place, I don't see how we're going to avoid really arguing seriously in the next year or so about whether or not the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, maybe the wealthiest 5% of Americans, I'm sure that's going to be reconsidered by Congress in the coming year or so.
Stephen Wiseman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Stephen R. Wiseman is the author of the new book, The Great Tax Wars. He's on the editorial staff of The New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Modernistic, the new solo recording by pianist Jason Moran. And we talk with Sarah Vowell about her new book, The Partly Cloudy Patriot.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Sarah Vowell, often reads her funny and perceptive essays on the public radio program This American Life. She's a contributing editor for the show. If you know her work, then you know that she is immersed in music and movies. Her first collection of essays was even named after a line in The Godfather, "Take the cannoli." So the focus of her new book may seem somewhat out of character, her life as a history buff. Her new book is called The Partly Cloudy Patriot. In her chapter, God Will Give You Blood to Drink in a Souvenir Shot Glass, she confesses that she often spends vacations touring historical sites and devotes a considerable part of the rest of her life to reading about history. I asked her to read an excerpt of that chapter.
I am 1-1-800 number away from ordering the Time Life World War II series off the TV. I have set my alarm so I wouldn't miss a C-SPAN morning live remote from the house of the Revolutionary War pamphleteer Thomas Paine. I celebrated my 30th birthday at Grant's Tomb. My airport reading material, a novelization of Gettysburg here, a Lyndon Johnson biography there, always receives an approving glance from whatever middle-aged man on my flight is perusing the new Stephen Ambrose book. Because every domestic flight requires a middle-aged man with a Stephen Ambrose book in his carry-on luggage. It's an FAA regulation. The historical periods I like to learn about aren't so much costume dramas as slasher flicks. The French Revolution is a favorite because it features the beloved plot of carnage in service of democracy, but I prefer American history. And if I had to pick my pet domestic bloodbaths, nothing beats Salem or Gettysburg. I'm a sucker for Puritan New England and the Civil War because those two subjects feature the central tension of American life, the conflict between freedom and community, between individual will and the public good. That is a fancy way of hinting that sometimes other people get on my nerves. I'm two parts loner and one part joiner, so I feel at home delving into the epic struggles for togetherness. Plus, Puritanism and the war between the states inspired some of the greatest American writing, scary sermons and Lincoln speeches, writing which asked, to me, the question, if you're so gung-ho on the fellowship of your countrymen, why have you had your phone off the hook for the last 4 days?
That's Sarah Vowell reading from her new book, The Partly Cloudy Patriot. Describe why you titled your book that.
Well, I guess there are a couple of answers to that. For a long time, I didn't have a title, and I was trying to come up with something that captured my ambivalence toward the country, because I can be incredibly patriotic, but on the other hand, I have a lot of misgivings and qualms and no problem with expressing those. And I was reading Thomas Paine's pamphlet, American Crisis, which was written during the American Revolution. And it starts with that famous passage about these are the times that try men's souls and that the sunshine patriot and the winter soldier will, shrink from duty. And I really like that passage because it's just so unambiguous about, we have to win this war and let's get cracking. And while I admire that sentiment, I'm always a little more gray than that. And so I thought, I'm not sunshine patriot, but I'm partly cloudy.
Sarah, you love history, and you write about that in your first essay in your new collection. And this essay finds you at Gettysburg on the 137th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address. So you're there for another reading of it. There's a paragraph here I'd like you to read about loving history.
I could say that I've come to Gettysburg as a rubbernecking tourist, that I've shown up to force myself to mull over the consequences of a war I never think about, because that would make a better story. A gum-chewing, youngish person who says like too much comes face to face with the horrors of war and learns something. But, this story isn't like that. Fact is, I think about the Civil War all the time, every day. I can't even use a cotton ball to remove my eye makeup without spacing out about slavery's favorite cash crop. And that line from Lincoln's second inaugural address that it may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. Well, that, and why does black eyeliner smudge way more than brown?
That's Sarah Vowell reading from one of her essays in her new collection, The Partly Cloudy Patriot. Sarah, when did you become that interested in history?
Well, I was always interested in it, I guess, because of my father and my grandfather, and they would always talk about history just as history starring our family, you know. So the reason we were all born in Oklahoma was because of Jacksonian Indian removal policy, because of the removal of our Cherokee ancestors on the Trail of Tears to eastern Oklahoma. So that's why we were there. Or the Civil War wasn't just some abstract thing. Our great great-grandfather was in it as a Confederate, or, you know, the Depression was something that happened to my grandparents, and one day a guy shows up for supper and my grandmother feeds him and he leaves $20 under the dinner plate, and that was pretty Boy Floyd. So I guess we always had this kind of Zelig-like feeling for history as just something that we had been vaguely part of.
And what about in school? Did history classes work for you on that same level?
Not really. I mean, I don't know that it was always taught so inspiringly. You know, they never really gave a reason for it. Or, like, on the first day, they would always say that thing about we must learn history in order not to repeat it, which isn't really true if you end up you know, a silly person like me. Like, they would teach us about Napoleon, so then I would know not to invade Russia in winter, which I don't really use very often. Whereas if they just told you, you know, you could learn about this thing, and then the world is just full of all these stories, and everywhere you go, you could feel part of this continuum, or just the perspective it gives. Like, my whole motto in life, in any situation, is it could be worse. And history is great for my motto, because in any situation, it could always be worse if you know the stories of history. Like, one thing I think about all the time is Andersonville Prison, the Confederate prison, you know? So if something doesn't go my way, I can't get a cab in the rain. I just say to myself, Andersonville, and I imagine myself dying of gangrene as a prisoner of war, and then I'd perk up.
So is love of history is in part a way to make you feel better
about
facing the problems in your own life?
Yeah, I guess.
My guest is Sarah Vowell. Her new book is called The Partly Cloudy Patriot. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Sarah Vowell. She's a contributing editor for the public radio program This American Life. Vowell often writes about movies and music. Her new book, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, is about her life as a history buff. You go to a lot of historic landmarks, and you even do this on vacations. What are some of the places you've visited in the past few years?
Let's see. Dallas, where Kennedy was shot. Salem. I love Salem, where the witch trials happened. Little Bighorn Battlefield. I've been there maybe 3 times in the last 2 years. The Teddy Roosevelt's cabin in North Dakota. A lot of presidential libraries, including Nixon, Eisenhower, Kennedy, somebody else. Oh, Johnson, my favorite, Johnson. Yeah, Gettysburg. I've been to Vicksburg. I was just somewhere. Oh, Wounded Knee. I was just at Wounded Knee on vacation this summer.
In your book, you write about how you spoke to a friend of yours about your love for historical places and your emphasis on historical places that have some kind of disaster attached to them.
Uh-huh.
And the friend you talk to about this is somebody who counsels people who survived torture.
Right.
So what did you tell her? What did she tell you?
Well, I called her right after I got back from Salem, and I had a really good time in Salem. But I felt kind of guilty about it. You know, like one of my favorite things that happened in Salem was that I was at this gift shop, and a guy in the gift shop asked the cashier, "Hey, you got any witchcraft trivets?" And she said, "You mean a trivet with a witch on it?" And I just thought that was really funny, you know, that this guy wanted, you know, that this, I don't know, I mean, it was horrible. This horrible thing happened here and 20 innocent people were executed, but this guy wanted to remember it by buying a thing he could protect his table from a burning saucepan with. And that just cracked me up, but then I felt bad about it. And I had such a good time in Salem. And I mean, it's a really pretty town and there's a lot to do. And you know, just it's kind of kooky, like the Witch Dungeon Museum and things like that. And so I got home and I felt guilty because, you know, ultimately this whole town's tourism industry is based around the fact that 20 innocent people were executed. And so I called my friend Kate, and Kate is a psychologist with the program for survivors of torture. And she's one of the funniest people I know, but it's weird that she has this torture job. She talks to people with actual historical problems. So I called her with mine, which was, why do I go to these places and why don't I ever go anywhere fun? Why don't I go to Hawaii or Martha's Vineyard or the Caribbean? Why, you know, like I went to the homestead of this elderly woman who was executed for witchcraft this weekend and had a great time. What is wrong with me? And, she basically told me, well, she said, it's not denial, it's the opposite of denial. And her idea was that I go to these places and I enjoy them, but that my humor about them is full of, she called it anxious giggles, and that I use that I have an uneasy relationship with American history, which I do, because it's really bloody and dark, besides being inspiring. And that I go to these places and joke around and stuff, and I use humor as a way of managing my anxiety.
How does that strike you?
That seems about right.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I manage my anxiety a lot, I guess.
Do you wonder what it would be like if, say, a couple of decades from now, a young version of Sarah Vow spends a holiday weekend at Ground Zero and buys some souvenirs? Is that the kind of thing that you think about?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's my nightmare. But I think one thing about historical places is the distance, you know, like that makes me cringe when you said that, because that just happened and it's still happening. And yeah, but there's something about distance that enables you to think about them. But I mean, and it's not completely sarcastic on my part. I don't have a lot to offer the world. I have very limited talents. And one thing I can do for the dead is I can remember them. I'm not necessarily the spokesperson they would want, but, you know, they got me anyway. And even though I do joke around and have fun at places I'm not necessarily supposed to have fun at, I do tell their stories, albeit in a very often peculiar way.
Sarah Vowell is my guest. She has a new collection of pieces, and it's called The Partly Cloudy Patriot. You mentioned parenthetically someplace in the book that you had a hearing problem as a kid. What was the problem and how was it diagnosed? You love music so much. Music is so much a part of your life.
That's how it was diagnosed. I was very small and my parents just thought I was really obstinate because I would never do what they would tell them. And one day I was watching the Mickey Mouse Club show on TV, and there's that part that goes, "Forever let us hold our banner high." and I was singing for every little polar bear to hide. And my mom was like, what? What are you singing? Because I think a bear was holding the banner, so I was just taking clues, you know. And so then I had to get my hearing checked, and then those tests just terrified me because I would just fake my way, you know, where you hold your arm up. And right. I would just fake it the whole time. I couldn't hear anything. And so, so I had to get tubes in my ears for quite a while. I think that might also, compound neuroses, it might be another reason I'm afraid of water, because when you have tubes in your ears, you can't get your ears wet. And so I was terrified of getting my ears wet. And it would happen so early, and it was diagnosed so early. I think the whole thing was taken care of by the time I was maybe five.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I still probably talk a little weird, but I don't know it has anything to do with that. I think maybe it has to do with being raised by Okies, but otherwise, yeah.
Well, since we've established that you love music,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you to choose something that you've been listening to lately that you really love a lot that we can play to close.
Oh, let's see. This is such an opportunity. I really love Ricky Nelson's Lonesome Town.
Oh, okay. Why have you been listening to it?
I like those kind of panoramic, atmospheric songs like that, you know, kind of like Eddie Arnold's Cattle Call, you know, that has that yodeling at the beginning, and there's just this kind of very American, desolate, open feel.
Now, is Ricky Nelson somebody who you knew from childhood or somebody who you caught up with later?
I think my uncles were big rockabilly fans, so yeah, I heard him as a kid, but it's really only within the last couple of years that I've come back to him.
Well, good choice. Thanks for choosing that.
Yeah. Going to Lonesome Town is like coming home.
Okay. Sarah Vowell, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Sarah Vowell's new book is called The Partly Cloudy Patriot.
There's a place where lovers go to cry their troubles away, and they call it Lonesome Town, where the broken hearts stay. You can buy a dream or two to last you all through the years, and the only price you pay is a heart full of tears. Going down to Lonesome Town, where the broken heart stays. Going down to Lonesome Town to cry my troubles away. In the town of broken dreams, the streets are filled with regret. Maybe down in Lonesome Town I can learn to forget. Maybe down in Lonesome Town I can learn to forget.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Modernistic, the new solo piano CD by Jason Moran. This is Fresh Air. The 27-year-old jazz pianist Jason Moran has studied with keyboard modernists Jackie Byard, Mujal Richard Abrams, and Andrew Hill, and recorded with veteran jazz stars Sam Rivers and Vaughn Freeman. For the last 5 years, he's also enjoyed a close touring and recording collaboration with forward-looking saxophonist Greg Osby. Moran's fourth album, his first solo record, is now out. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's the one he's been waiting for.
Jason Moran on stride pianist James P. Johnson's 1929 composition, You've Got to Be Modernistic. It gave Moran the title for his new Blue Note CD, Modernistic, and set the tone for the whole program. I'm not cutting edge and avant-garde, Moran says. I'm modernistic. I bring new ideas to old things. That was Johnson's method, too. His tune combined old-fashioned ragtime rhythms with then-modern harmonies and whole-tone scales. James P. Johnson respected and kidded the past at the same time. Jason Moran, same deal. From the first, it was obvious that Jason Moran is a gifted piano player, but he did have one bad habit. He'd ride the sustain pedal that lets notes keep ringing after the fingers have moved off the keys. When he used it too much, his sound could get muddy. But here he's banished that tick, sounding more crisp even on the romantic numbers. His combination of original and classic pieces lets you hear what he gets from and adds to his inspirations. One unlikely classic he treats is the 1982 hip-hop breakthrough Planet Rock by the Bronx's Afrika Bambaataa and Soul Sonic Force. Moran evokes the rhythm of the rapping and a catchy riff sampled off an old Kraftwerk record. He also prepares the piano by clipping small objects to or wedging them between the strings for a nice snappy drum sound. You remember the original?
The Soul Sonic Force.
That's a nice example of how music can take on a totally different character with a change of instrumentation. Jason Moran's version of Planet Rock also touches on another project of his, translating the pitches and rhythms of various spoken languages to piano. On his new CD, he transforms Planet Rock even further. Working on his arrangement, Moran came up with a new bass line which grew into another piece even more removed from its source, Planet Rock Postscript. The hip-hop rhythm and sing-song tune are barely a memory. Thank you. That sequence says a lot about how Jason Moran's mind works, making his CD modernistic, a sort of autobiography in progress. In an echo of his early classical training, he plays a piece by 19th century composer Robert Schumann, shedding new light on his own more romantic stuff, which I confess I like less than his flashier numbers. Jason Moran is a curious listener who's humble about what he knows and what he doesn't, who's obviously committed to long-term growth, and who's able to fold widespread material into a personal vision. That's enough to make him one of the rare up-and-comers who make you optimistic for the future of jazz.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed pianist Jason Moran's new solo CD, Modernistic, on Blue Note. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Also by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The New Rabbi, A Congregation Searches for Its Leader by Stephen Fried. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist MJ Akbar, founder and editor-in-chief of India's English-language newspaper, The Asian Age. He's a Muslim whose new book considers the history of jihad. We'll also talk about relations between India and Pakistan and reaction in India to the Bush administration plan to overthrow Saddam Hussein. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.